KLOS and KLOS HD1, Los Angeles. This is the rock of Southern California. Now, shining a light on the people, organizations, and events that bring Southern Californians together. This is Spotlight on the Community with your host, Doug McIntyre.
We'll circle back to a story we've been following closely, which is the imbecilic road diet that City Councilman Mike Bonin and the City of Los Angeles imposed on the people in Mar Vista, Playa del Rey, the folks coming up from the South Bay to try to get to Santa Monica, the only alternative to the dreaded 405. It's Venice Boulevard. They took lanes away from cars to give them to bicycles, all under the auspices of this Vision Zero plan, this utopian dream that there would be zero pedestrian deaths in Los Angeles by 2025. And, of course, the only thing this has done is slow traffic that was already awful to a complete gridlock. There was a little bit of pushback in the right direction over the weekend. And to talk to us about that is a member of the Keep LA Moving group, which is an association of neighbors. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the show, John Russo. John, how are you?
Good morning, Doug. Thanks for having me back.
This is kind of a cryptic report from Fox 11 that says that some things were changed back to the way they were originally. What was changed back?
So a stretch of road going eastbound between Nicholson and Jefferson was changed back to two lanes. The westbound lane is still just a single lane, but on the east side, for about maybe three-quarters of a mile on the kind of northeastern border of Playa del Rey, that stretch of road is now two lanes again.
All right, well, that's at least one small step in the right direction, but has it made an appreciable difference in traffic?
You know, I think it will make a small difference. It'll help out the – there was a great turn off of Nicholson onto Culver that was very difficult because you had a stream of cars coming down the hill, merging into a single lane with a stream of cars coming through Playa del Rey. And so now when you come down the hill, it opens up into a second lane. But in the big picture, you know, it really isn't going to make a big difference. You still have the bottlenecks over on Vista Del Mar starting at Imperial. We still have the bottleneck on Jefferson, the right turn going up Jefferson, that single lane. You know, we haven't done anything for the westbound lane. So in the evening, we're going to be seeing no differences in terms of travel times, gridlock, commutes. So it's a step, as you said, it's a step in the right direction, but we feel there's a lot more that still needs to be done.
Now, Mike Bonin, the city councilman, obviously represents that area, who, I guess, spearheaded this, said that this is a pilot program, and he's quoted as saying, a pilot program is something that you try and modify and change. So we've had it for 4 to 6 weeks. This, the first set of changes and modifications we're doing, there will be more. On July 29th, which is a Saturday, at Loyola Marymount University, there's going to be a community meeting. I don't know if Mr. Bonin will be there. Thus far, anyway, he has not personally appeared at any of these meetings. It was one at the Mar Vista Library. He's had staff there. So whether he will be there or not to discuss this with the community remains to be seen. And in his defense, there are people who support this. There are people who are voicing their support for it. I just think that on both the way the process was handled without very much public notice or public input, there's no defense. And you know, personally, I just don't believe there's any defense for taking lanes away from commuters in the most traffic-snarled city in the world. I mean, it's just impossible to justify doing this in Southern California, given what we've got. Until there's a practical alternative for people to get to work and get their kids to school, it's unconscionable that they'd make traffic worse deliberately.
Yeah, it's really made it tough for us here. You know, people coming from the South Bay, especially for us here in Playa del Rey, you know, we're seeing this traffic backed up pretty much every day, all day, just weekends included. And many people have been telling me, you know, I feel like a prisoner in my own home. I can't get out to, you know, go to the marina to go shopping. I can't go to the Home Depot over there on Jefferson. What used to be a 5-minute drive is now a 20, 25-minute drive. You know, it's really, really made life difficult. And to talk to the safety argument, you know, Mike Bonin has said that this was done all in the name of safety. We have to take these lanes down to single lanes in the name of safety. Well, since this pilot project started about June 6th, we've had 14 accidents out there on these streets. Compare that to a yearly average of 11. That's Mike Bonin's data. For the last 5 years, we averaged 11 accidents a year on those roads. We've had 14 in 4 weeks.
And all of this goes back to the tragic death of a 16-year-old young woman a few years back that resulted in a $10 million lawsuit against the city of Los Angeles. And she was, if I got this correct, trying to get to the beach. So she was cutting across Venice Boulevard, which is obviously a busy street, got struck and killed. By all means, we should be improving the crosswalks with new technology. And if necessary, we should be building bridges, you know, pedestrian bridges that cross the road so that people have safe access to the beach. But there's got to be some kind of practical solution that can improve safety for people crossing to get to the beach without imposing further onerous restrictions on people who are just trying to go. I mean, the days when people would go for a pleasure drive in Los Angeles, when was the last time anybody drove for pleasure in Los Angeles? Maybe in those erectile dysfunction commercials we see with the silvered hair foxes driving their vintage cars up the PCH, you know, when they're not hopping into a clawfoot bathtub, you know, but nobody's driving for pleasure in Los Angeles anymore.
Yeah, I mean, driving on the street you mentioned where this tragic accident happened, Vista Del Mar, I mean, that really has just turned into a driver's nightmare on the weekends. I mean, they took what used to be two lanes in each direction is now a single lane, and they've moved parking to the west side. And now we see that they've added more parking, extended the parking. Because there's only one lane in each direction, you have a lot of people wanting to go to the beach. Traffic is just backed up maybe half a mile down Vista Del Mar. And now people trying to get to those parking spots are making illegal U-turns across oncoming traffic. They're driving down this parking buffer lane that's supposed to allow cars to back out before they can get in, before they merge into traffic. I mean, I was parked out there. I was on that gridlock last weekend, and in the course of about 15 minutes, I saw three cars probably doing 30 miles an hour at least, just screaming down that buffer lane where there's people walking, there's cars backing out. I mean, it's definitely not a safe situation for anybody. And there's still jaywalking going across, jaywalkers going across from the east side because they did leave parking near the park there on the east side. So we haven't solved the jaywalking problem. And I really believe it's made everyone a lot more dangerous on that street.
We're talking with John Russo, who is a Playa del Rey resident and a member of the group Keep LA Moving. Tell us about Keep LA Moving. How do people reach your group, and who is it, and how did it come about?
So Keep LA Moving is a group of neighbors, people affected by these traffic lane reductions. And we started this Keep LA Moving as an umbrella group to reach out to other communities. So we have here in Playa del Rey, our faction would be Keep PDR Moving. And that's also a website you could go to. Then there's the Venice people. They have a Restore Venice, which we have linked to our Keep LA Moving. And we're also reaching out to other communities such as Brentwood, Silver Lake, West Side, West LA. They're also impacted or soon to be impacted by these lane closures. So anyone can just go to the website, Keep LA Moving, and you'll see the links to the other communities. And there's a Contact Us button there. On Keep PDR Moving, we have a Contact Us button. And if you're being impacted, you're being affected by these lane reductions or soon-to-come lane reductions, because this isn't just a Playa del Rey issue. It's not just a Mar Vista issue. I mean, this is really part of Mobility Plan 2035, which Mayor Garcetti plans to roll out across the city. And, you know, what will really impact us here in Playa del Rey and on the west side is they want to do this to Lincoln Boulevard, a single lane in each direction up to Rose. And the city of Santa Monica just posted their reimagining Lincoln project, where they want to take that single lane reduction through the city of Santa Monica from Rose all the way to San Vicente. Sepulveda, Wilshire Boulevard, Pico Boulevard, these are all streets that are on the chopping block. And
including Lancashire out in the San Fernando Valley, Paul Kerkorian, city councilman there, put that temporarily on hold. So it's already on the east side of Los Angeles. It's a citywide, and this is very, very important. I mean, people just casually listening might think, well, I don't live in Mar Vista. This isn't my problem. I don't go down there. But the bottom line is, it's your government deliberately making traffic worse. Now, just chew on that for a second. Rather than making traffic better, which is what we're hoping that they're doing, and they always talk about gridlock, their answer to this is to make your commute so horrible that you will willingly, you'll put your car on Craigslist and say, I'm done, I'm never driving again. I'm just going to take public transportation. The problem is, we don't have public transportation. There are some lucky neighborhoods that have an alternative to cars, but not many. And that's the problem. At some point in the future, and I hope in the near future, we will. With all those Measure M dollars. But they're diverting some of the Measure M dollars to actually narrow the roads to make it harder for people to get to work and pick up their kids. And that's not the function of government.
Yeah, that's a fantastic point, Doug. And that's a point I always try to make to people, that really it's not just a, as you said, a local problem. It's not a Playa del Rey problem. It's not a Mar Vista problem. It is a citywide problem. And exactly that, our government is really, it's supposed to be helping us. It's supposed to be making our lives easier. And within a few years, they will make all our lives very difficult. The concept of going to, over from Playa del Rey to Dodger Stadium will be a thing of the past. If it takes 2 hours to get there, who's going to want to fight that traffic in the middle of the day to go see a Dodger game? We'll sit at home on our, watching on our 70-inch TVs in the comfort of our home. And that's just not what LA, the mobile city.
That is, of course, if you get the Dodgers. It just seems like everything in Los Angeles is conspiring to ruin your summer. All right, listen, John, we'll continue to follow. Remember, folks, if you're interested on Saturday, July 29th, there will be a community meeting on this topic of road diets at Loyola Marymount University, and we'll cover that as well. You can be sure of that. John, thanks so much. I'm sure we'll be talking to you again.
Okay, thank you very much. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about this.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, as we speak from the luxury of our air-conditioned suites here at KBC Radio, there are men and women working in the 146th Airlift Wing in the California Air National Guard, and they are ready to fly C-130J aircraft to help fight the wildfires. They've been doing this for 43 years, and this is always a dangerous work. We saw yesterday, we just told you about this terrible tragedy in Mississippi where a C-130 went down and lost 16 lives. Joining us right now to talk about the amazing operation that we take for granted, the Modular Airborne Firefighting System, or MAFS. It's a pleasure to welcome aboard Colonel Brian Allen, who is the California Air National Guard commander in charge of the country's four wings of the Modular Airborne Firefighting System Airlift Expeditionary Group. Welcome aboard, Colonel Allen. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Doug. How are you?
Excellent. And your men and women, they fly out of Point Magoo. Do I have that correct?
That's correct. Point Magoo, just located just north of Los Angeles and south of Santa Barbara on the coast, right near Oxnard and Ventura.
And this is the Channel Islands Air National Guard Station. And 43 years you've been doing this. Now, we're used to seeing the super scoopers come down from Canada, and we always, it's sort of like the swallows returning to Capistrano when the fire season, we're waiting for the super scoopers to come down from Canada. But this is a resource that the Air Force has made available to the federal government during fire season now for almost a half a century. And tell us, what is involved in deploying these aircraft?
Well, and you're absolutely right. This mission set that we have is a combination of Air National Guard and Air Force Reserve personnel using United States Air Force C-130 aircraft in an aerial firefighting role. It's really the first really solid use of military assets to support Californians and Americans directly within the states to save lives and property. And so we take these aircraft and modify them to do aerial firefighting. We're a surge capacity. We're a tool, just like the super scoopers you talked about. We're a tool for a specific purpose, and we're usually called when they run out of other resources. So just as we call the super scoopers down from Canada when we get into the hot and heavy part of the fire season, when the rest of the nation starts to catch on fire and they run out of commercial and civil assets, they give us a call, and we, our citizen airmen, folks that are airline pilots and bankers and educators and just regular average citizens, they drop what they're doing in their civil role in their regular employment, and they go out to the base and they put the system in the aircraft, and we go out and fly in support of either Cal Fire or U.S. Forest Service or Bureau of Land Management to put fires out.
Does the governor have to invoke the mission? In other words, to deploy the National Guard, normally you need either, you usually need a state governor to make a request, right?
Well, that's one way we get involved. California is a little unique in that we have a long-standing relationship with Cal Fire and the California Department of Office of Emergency Services. And in a state role, as a National Guard's folks, we have a responsibility to protect California first when we're at peacetime. And then when the nation goes to war, obviously, we pick up and go fight our nation's wars. But in peacetime, our first and primary responsibility is to protect Californians. So the governor can call up his National Guard and do all sorts of things. And that includes aerial firefighting with us, or it could be hand crews, or it could be emergency relief for earthquakes, damages, and that kind of stuff. So we, in that role, the governor can call us up and has, in this case, called us up. Now, normally, however, we usually get called through a process that's called a request for assistance from the United States Forest Service through an organization up in Boise, Idaho, called the National Interagency Fire Center. And that the NIFC, the National Interagency Fire Center, manages the large air tanker fleet throughout the country. And so normally we get a call from NIFC to say, hey, we've run out of large air tankers. We need the MAFs. There are 8 MAFs aircraft in the country. There are 4 airlift wings that perform the MAFs mission. We've got 2 here at Channel Islands, California. So California is very well protected. There are 2 in Cheyenne, Wyoming, 2 in Reno, Nevada, and 2 in Colorado Springs. So they're really very well strategically located in the western United States. But in the California role, when California turns hot and heavy, or if Cal Fire believes that they need to get the fire out quickly, they can make a request and through the governor's office, and they activate the California National Guard in a state role, and then we can get out on the fires very, very quickly within California.
We're talking with Colonel Brian Allen, who is the Air National Guard commander in charge of the country's 4 wings of the MAF. Mobile Airborne Firefighting Systems Airlift Expeditionary Group. Let's talk about what the crews, and you have 16 crews that are trained and certified to do this, and it takes a lot of training to do this because you're flying low, slow, and heavy when you're fighting fires, and you're flying through, obviously, dense atmosphere because there's a lot of smoke in the air. You're flying low over mountainous terrain oftentimes with a lot of air traffic. So it's a real dangerous mission. There's nothing routine about this.
And that's true. We call it a uniquely risky endeavor, not to frighten people, but it is risky. We take in our case, a 165,000-pound aircraft. We fly it at its one of its slowest airspeeds at about 120 knots, and we drop at about 150 feet in canyon and mountainous terrain next to fire plumes following a lead plane in mixed with rotary wing and other fixed wing aircraft in the air, and dozers and engine crews and hand crews on the ground to apply about 27,000 pounds of retardant that we drop. So it's quite a challenge to fly the mission. So we only take the most experienced and the best flight crew members that we have within the Air National Guard and U.S. Air Force. And it takes quite a number of years to be able to progress, to be able to become one of the aerial firefighting pilots, and then to be able to move to the left seat, which is the seat that you would be the pilot in command. Takes even more years to be able to do that safely. So our endeavor is to conduct this mission in a safe, effective, and efficient manner. But it is uniquely risky, and we do take we do everything we can to minimize the risks while we do this. So these aircraft, by the way, are C-130 tactical aircraft that we use to take into a wartime combat scenario. So the training that our crews have for the wartime mission is very complementary for the aerial firefighting mission. You can think of us going into a hostile area in overseas and inserting troops or dropping cargo in a low altitude in a hostile environment. We'll translate that to aerial firefighting. It's very similar. So this is an optimum mission for the National Guard and Air Force Reserve to do this kind of mission with the same kind of training, the same kind of aircraft. And then we take the cream of the crop crews, put them in the aircraft, and train them. And we train annually. Every year we go through a recurrent training process. So we get with U.S. Forest Service, Cal Fire, and BLM, conduct a large-scale training event And in fact, some folks may have seen us up north, just north of Los Angeles, like toward Lake Elizabeth this past year, dropping water. So we dropped clear water out on some of the ranges up just south of Lancaster and north of Lake Castaic.
Hey, Colonel.
Go ahead.
Sorry. Hi, it's Leanne. How are you? And just so all the listeners are aware, this is my husband's boss out here. How are you?
We're trying not to get him fired, by the way.
Exactly. My husband, by the way, was out. He got launched yesterday and was doing some drops in Northern California on some fires. But will you explain to people? I know when I first found out about the whole MAFS mission, you know, you think of fighting fires from the sky, and I always thought, oh, these are big planes dropping water, actually putting out the fire. But you guys really drop FOSCHECK, which is the big, you know, the kind of red dusty stuff that we see on the mountainsides, and you guys are actually trying to break the fire. Is that correct? Will you explain that to our listeners?
Certainly. The FOSCHECK is a retardant. Water is a retardant too, but it doesn't last very long. So when it comes to trying to stop a large fire, we use tactics and techniques to try to build a line that says, okay, we're going to defend from this point and try to stop the fire before it can move beyond that. And we try to use natural breaks such as rocky ridges and tops of ridges and things like that. And we'll apply a retardant on that line so that the fire will burn into it and then slow down and basically try to stop it. Now, retardant is basically plant fertilizer. If you can think of Miracle-Gro with a little bit of red dye, just the right consistency of Miracle-Gro with red food coloring in it so that we can see it. We put 3,000 gallons of that retardant into our aircraft and drop it in a line. We can drop water, but water only lasts maybe 15 minutes before it evaporates. So we can drop water directly onto a fire to kind of cool it down. But rotary wing aircraft are much more suited at dousing a fire specifically with water, and it doesn't last. Retardant, because it is like fertilizer, it will stay onto the fuel, and it inhibits combustion, and it can stay on the fuel for several months, and it goes away only when it's washed off. What's nice about it is when it does wash off, it's actually plant fertilizer, so it can actually help the plants regrow.
Colonel, it's rare that we see aerial operations at night when we have wildfires. In extreme cases, we've seen that happen. Do we have technology on the horizon that will make it safer for pilots to be able to fly missions at night?
That's coming. It's not quite here yet. Night vision goggle operations are conducted by LA County and I think one or two U.S. Forest Service rotary wing aircraft. The helicopters, they can pause. They can hover. C-130s and other large air tankers can't just hover. And it's very difficult for us to see high tension lines and poles and other very fine small objects that aren't illuminated at night with our current night vision technology. That coupled with the fire itself burns quite bright when you're looking at it under NVGs. So the technology isn't quite there to be able to give us enough fidelity of vision to be able to conduct air tanker operations safely quite yet. One day I think we'll be able to do that when the technology of the night vision equipment improves. But LA County, I believe, has got one or two night vision-equipped rotary wing helicopters. I think Forest Service has got one or two as well right now. And that kind of makes some sense on the rotary wing side. They have to do quite a bit of pre-mission planning, knowing where the power lines are and the antennas and any kind of towers that are out there. They certainly don't want to snag those and hurt themselves doing that kind of thing.
Colonel, I just wanted to get you to weigh in on a different topic, unfortunately, a tragic topic. As we all know, we lost a C-130 in Mississippi yesterday. It was an air tanker refueling plane. And as a commander of a unit that flies C-130s, I was wondering if you had any thoughts or insights into what may have happened there. Tragic loss of 16 lives.
You know, at this point, I don't have any details other than that the aircraft went down. It was a Marine KC-135. or MC-135J. It's a J model, very similar to what we fly, and it's tragic. Our thoughts and prayers go out to the family members of the Patriots that were on board that aircraft. C-130s are pretty reliable. I've got to say, over the 60-some-odd years that these aircraft have been flying, it's actually very unusual for a C-130 to go down. And it's crushing to our community because we're all tight-knit community. Most everybody that flies C-130s goes through Little Rock, Arkansas for training, just about everybody. All the pilots and loadmasters, navigators, flight engineers all go through Little Rock. So we share a common background in that. But aviation in itself is a risky endeavor. So we've actually lost one of our MAFS aircraft here a few years ago, MAFS 7. There were four Patriots lost their lives in that aircraft. Two of them made it out, and they were actually fighting fires in support of Forest Service up in South Dakota. So, yeah, I really don't know the details about that C-130 back there. It is tragic. Our thoughts and prayers are with them. And like I say, C-130s, they're very reliable when it comes to airframes. It's a pretty stout airplane.
We'll certainly keep our thoughts and prayers with the men and women who serve under you, and we appreciate you coming on every day. We hope we didn't do too much damage to Chris's career.
Thank you, Brian.
Anytime, Leanne.
Colonel Brian Allen of the California Air National Guard. He's a commander.
You're listening to Spotlight on the Community on 95.5 KLOS. I'm Doug McIntyre. Make sure you listen to McIntyre in the morning, weekdays 5 to 10 on Talk Radio 790 KBC AM.
95.5 KLOS.
Spotlight on the Community now resumes with Doug McIntyre.
Ladies and gentlemen, as you know, we are the homeless capital of North America, certainly. L.A. County has a real crisis on our hands on two fronts. The number of people who are living on the streets or living in cars, and affordable housing. It is not a secret that we have one of the most expensive places to live, and nobody seems to know what the answer is. And this is despite the fact that the taxpayers, the voters of L.A. County and the city of Los Angeles have voted Measure H and Triple H to raise sales taxes in order to combat homelessness. There's a proposal now for a state sales tax increase to address the homeless issue. And to talk to us about it right now is the woman who proposed it, Assemblywoman from Salinas, Anna M. Cabrero. Good morning, Assemblywoman. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing terrific. Thank you.
I appreciate you coming on with us. And Caballero, I apologize for mispronouncing your name. So what is it specifically that you're proposing?
Well, the proposal is to take a quarter-cent sales tax that is currently unused. It was originally proposed to pay down debt during the economic downturn in the economy. It expired and it's done. Debt is paid off, and so it is currently unused. And the idea is to take this money, if it's approved by the voters, and try to resolve some of the problems that we have around housing. Number one is to support low and median income families to buy their first home. Two is to focus on our homeless population and develop shelters and emergency housing to get them off the streets. We're spending an inordinate amount of money right now just cleaning up after them, and it's not a very humane and realistic long-term solution. To take care of seniors, to create more affordable housing for seniors, and then multi-family housing or apartments or condos.
Now, we've covered this issue extensively on the show for many, many years, and we talked to a lot of real estate people and development people and city and county officials. And we keep coming down to one of the big problems, certainly in Los Angeles and Orange County, this is the case. The land that you build on is very expensive. So how do we build affordable housing in a place like Los Angeles in particular, where the footprint that any building you put up to house, whether it's seniors or street people, is itself a fortune? It costs a fortune just to acquire the property.
You're right. You're absolutely right. So part of the solution is that we got to think of housing a little bit differently. Frankly, the builder community looks at housing and says, we want to build a 2,500-square-foot home with a white picket fence on undeveloped land. And we don't have that anymore in many of our communities. We've got to look at properties that I would describe as underperforming. The old strip malls, for example, the old malls that are no longer functioning well economically because we've gone to superstores or we've changed the way that we do our shopping. Those parcels really could be reutilized and create an opportunity to have commercial or retail underneath and residential above. And what you're doing is you're creating a walkable community so people can walk in into that property. You reduce parking, you increase densities, you increase floor area ratios. Those provide you the opportunity to have villages, and people will have less of a need to use their car, because that's what we need to do. We need to get people out of their cars, and we also have to produce more affordable units for working families and the homeless as well, so that we're not looking at large space. We're just looking at a place that people can call their own.
Well, you know, obviously, getting people out of cars not only has a CO2 component to it, but we've got a gridlock issue that's, a perpetual problem, certainly here in Southern California, but in most urban centers. The problem that we've got is that we're oftentimes putting the cart before the horse. There isn't public transportation available for people. And we're forcing people out of cars with road diets when they don't have a viable alternative. We've had a big issue in Mar Vista down here in Los Angeles on that very issue. So this is a very complex issue, and it brings in a lot of sidebars to dealing with the homeless.
That's exactly right. So one of the challenges we have is that our transportation, our public transportation system, doesn't work very well, and we're going to need to really invest in the connections to be able to bring the suburbs or the areas that are not connected in our public transportation together. But for the most part, our strip malls and our malls are connected with a public transportation system. It may not be robust enough, but it provides an opportunity, I think, if we can marry the two, where we're putting the resources to add more capacity on the public transportation system and providing affordable housing or housing affordable to workers, because what you really want to do is transport workers close to those hubs so that they can move. But let me just add one other thing. There are many communities that don't want anybody moving into their community that they feel is either low or median income. And we just got to deal with that. We've got to face the NIMBYs and say, look, these individuals are already in our community. They're just living in really overcrowded situations. And speaking of Salinas, we just had a house fire on the 4th of July that burned out the residents in one house. It was 12 people, three families, living in less than 1,000 square feet. That's what happens when we don't have enough units and we don't have them affordable. People are forced to live in very significantly overcrowded situations.
We've covered this specifically.
Cultural. It's not. It's just not. These are unrelated families.
Well, you know, you're not going to like this. We're talking with Assemblywoman Anna Cabero. We have covered this story. There was a garage fire in Santa Ana about 5 years ago, and 12 people went to a Red Cross shelter. And
yes.
And this is where I'm with the NIMBYs. That what we have done is, because we have open borders and we have created sanctuary policies, we've actively encouraged the hemisphere's poorest to pour in, and they've taken us up on it, and it's completely changed the character of neighborhoods. And if you're a homeowner in California and you are on the hook for everything, every tax and fee that Sacramento or the county or the city comes up with, your home is your castle. And all of a sudden, the very people that have literally encouraged poverty and grown poverty, progressive, enlightened California, poised on the Pacific Rim with every natural advantage, not only has the highest number of poor people per capita, it's got the highest raw number of poor people, not Alabama and Mississippi. And we've done this deliberately. And what we do is we make our poor people compete with poor people, not just for jobs, but, you know, lowering the wages of working people, but also for housing. we have a low-income housing crisis. In L.A. County alone, we have an estimated 1.4 million people living illegally in the country. Well, what do you think that does to housing costs? Of course, nobody wants to touch this because we're supposed to believe that there's no difference between legal and illegal immigration.
You're right. I didn't care for it, but I think it's a good debate to have because I think part of the challenge is that California has been tremendously successful economically, and that's a magnet for people who are looking for opportunities to work. The immigrants that come don't come and get on welfare and just hang around. And frankly, if you went down to the shelters, and I'm talking about in my community, the people that are homeless are not immigrants, and the people that are homeless are already citizens, and they're not people.
But they are homeless. They are homeless because there is no low income housing for them because it is occupied by people who are in the country illegally. Largely.
No, I don't think so. In my community, it's the veterans, it's the drug addicts, it's the alcoholics, and
right.
And
but they're on the streets because of the
camp out
the
and
stock,
not work the, and the, not be. You know,
you're missing my point. Wait a second. Assemblywoman, please. You are dismissing my point.
Please
let me try to make it again. The reason that there is no stock of low-income housing for the veterans and the drug and alcohol people is because the low-income housing stock that was available is occupied by people who are here illegally. That's just a fact. It's not an opinion.
So I would beg to differ because I don't think the affordable housing. If you're talking about that has been subsidized by government, doesn't allow resources to be used for the undocumented.
I'm not talking about government subsidized. I'm just talking about illegal garage conversions. The house you described that had 12 people in it.
Got it.
This is just it's a factor. I'm not trying to get into some kind of a. I just want, if we want to solve the problem, my point, my frustration covering this for 20 years is that because of the protection, the political and cultural protection we are giving people in the country illegally, we're not allowed to talk about the real issue. We can't discuss the entire issue. It's taken off the table. And then we have a phony conversation about the magnitude of the problem. If we take the low-income units of housing that are occupied by people in the country illegally and put that on the marketplace again without the illegal population living there, we'd have tons of low-income housing for the native-born veterans and everybody else. But we're not even allowed to have that as a conversation point. And I'm just saying then we're having half the conversation. We need to deal all the cards on the table, and then we'll come to a solution. But we can't solve a problem if we're not willing to diagnose the full problem. That's my only point.
I see. Well, I understand what you're saying. And I think it's a good debate to have. But having spent pretty close to the same amount of time wrestling with the issue in my region, I just look at it a little bit differently, and I think that the data that I'm considering is a little bit different. But you know, I agree with you. It's part of the discussion that we probably need to have, and part of it is understanding. We started this conversation on the NIMBYs, and you agreed with the NIMBYs. We got to have a conversation about race and class in California if we're going to also have a discussion about immigration, because I think it's all tied up with each other. And California has historically had housing regulations or rules that segregated communities, and some of that segregation continues to exist, and it influences the NIMBY discussion as well. So as long as we're talking about immigration, I also think we need to talk about place, class and race, because I think they go hand in hand.
Fair enough, and I thank you so much for coming on and talking about it. It is a very important issue. We appreciate
Absolutely.
You being
well, thank
on
you very much, Doug, for the invitation. I appreciate it.
I want to pivot back to this story that we spent a significant amount of time talking about yesterday. As a book lover, and I am a book lover, this I find stunning. And I shouldn't be stunned, because we've covered aspects of it many, many times, including North Hollywood High School, where they've had academic decathlon championship teams, and the coach of the team, a high school teacher there, was bemoaning this a couple of years ago, that they have lots of students who come into high school who have never been assigned a book to read by their teachers in their lives. And now we're seeing this in colleges and universities. The National Association of Scholars points out that book virgins, they believe that there's 4 million of them, are students who are in colleges and universities who have never actually read an adult book voluntarily. Let's talk about this phenomenon with the Director of Communications at the National Association of Scholars, David Randall. David, welcome aboard. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you so much for having me here.
I appreciate this. I've been doing this for quite a while, and I think the first time that the light bulb went off for me was when McDonald's and Burger King started making cash registers that had pictures of the food items, silhouette pictures on the keys of the registers, so that when the employees were working and they had to ring up a milkshake, they'd look for the picture of the milkshake and hit that. And they were working their way around innumeracy and illiteracy. And we've done stories about large companies that have built classrooms into their workspaces, and they do remedial education because their workers can't read manuals, they can't write an email, they can't read safety warnings to be in compliance with OSHA regulations, etc. So we understand that there are people who are semi or sub-literate. But for people to be in colleges and universities who don't read long form seems to me to be counterintuitive to the very purpose of higher education.
Yeah, it is. There's been a great deal of changing the label. So what used to be a high school education is now being called a college education as often as not. And it's a great damage to the country and a great damage to the students.
Now, when you talk to non-readers, it's hard to convince somebody who hasn't experienced something that they're actually missing out on that experience because they haven't had it. So they only know the life that they've led. And in this day and age of video screens everywhere, we don't go 5 feet without having constant contact with visual medium. And I certainly use it all day long, and I love it like everybody else does. But there are some things that simply require more than 140 characters of a tweet. Some knowledge requires long-form reading, and some pleasurable experiences require long-form reading. And that's what I find so disturbing. There's nothing wrong with movies. Movies are a high art form. They could be a low art form, too, but they can be a high art form. But it's a different experience to see a film based on La Miserable versus reading Victor Hugo's La Miserable. It's a different sensual experience.
And for where we're coming from, we wish that the colleges were more self-confident and assured about offering better books, which are wonderful books, and saying forthrightly, these are really good, and they're really wonderful. Let us give you a really good book because we love it and we think you should too. Instead of just cringing and saying, we're going to give you something really, really simple because we have no confidence that you can do any better.
Yeah, and you're specifically referring to summer reading lists. A lot of colleges and universities, when they accept a prospective freshman for the incoming class, all the paperwork that gets sent out will include recommended reading, and more so, these are basically beach books. These are easy readers that you can fly through. They're not particularly challenging. And the idea that you would raise the bar and ask people to read literature, actual literature, that would stimulate vocabulary, ideas, a sense of the world and your place in it, is something that they're backing away from because I think they're afraid that... to me, I believe that all this stems from colleges and universities treating the students as customers rather than scholars.
That's a good part of it. We also have noticed that an awful lot of these books are, in effect, semi-soft sell propaganda for the latest good causes beloved by administrators who are somewhat politically on the left, And therefore, it's not just that it's simple-minded, it's that it's sort of a simple-minded, you know, let's be in favor of the latest cause of the day, whether it's environmentalism or illegal immigration or what have you. So it's one, that it's no good in terms of sheer quality, and then two, that sort of thing is sort of a soft sell propaganda too, which isn't great either.
Boy, I'm surprised to hear you say that. I mean, I thought I could link illegal immigration into any topic, but I didn't expect that agenda. I hadn't even considered that. But of course, it makes sense because, unfortunately, the modern American college and university has become almost a monolith in its political ideology and its thinking, certainly its worldview, which is a narrowing of the American mind, to paraphrase a book title from a few years ago, and sad, because it's the antithesis of what higher education is supposed to be about, which is the broadening of the mind, of exposing young scholars and young minds to as many ideas and as many points of view as possible, so that they leave that amazing experience having been exposed to things that they might normally not be exposed to. And it obviously opens up more possibilities for them.
Yeah, and we have our own, you know, recommendation of books which we think would be better at doing this. And it's everything from, you know, the Book of Job to Erasmus's, the Confession of Folly, Thomas More's Utopia, William Shakespeare, but Jane Austen's Persuasion, a wonderful book. And the point is, all of these, they're concerned about more than just the issues of the present day. They're something different from just an endless stream of memoirs by 24-year-olds, which really seems to be an awful lot of it. And a college and none of these books look like anything you'd be interested in 30 years from now. And you ought to be choosing a book that you would want people to remember 30 years from now and say, hey, that was great.
The big issue for me is that we're raising a generation, and of course this is a generalization because there are young readers, but we're raising a generation that does not read long form. And if you don't read long form, the eye is a muscle, then you can't read long form. It's very difficult to train somebody or a person to start reading books, adult literature, as adults when they haven't done it at a younger age. The eye is a muscle. It gets tired and they physically can't do it. And we seem to be so invested in visual technology that a lot of high school textbooks look like TV screens. There's just screen within screen, image within image. And that's where they think we're at. And I wonder where we're headed with all of this. I thank you for coming on. David Randall is the Director of Communications at the National Association of Scholars. Appreciate you talking with us.
This has been Spotlight on the Community, 95.5 KLOS. I'm Doug McIntyre, Talk Radio 790 KBC AM.